There's a poem by Rumi that has some lines in it that go something like, if you enter through the fire, you'll come out in the water. If you go into the water, you'll come out through the fire. And I think I was thinking of that this retreat. It occurred to me that you should be careful what you wish for. Because if you want to go through the water, I think the idea of water is like pleasant, refreshing, cool, nice. And you might come out in the fire. But if you start in the fire, maybe you'll come out in the water. Who knows what's going to happen? But here you are, first day of the retreat. And for some of you, there's probably some equivalent to fire the first day. How many of you were surprised by how tired you were today? A few of you? How many were surprised by the pain you felt, physical pain? And how many of you were surprised by the emotional pain that was here? Any of you had that? Some of you? So the question is, who was surprised? If I'd asked the question differently, now how many of you were tired today? And how many of you had pain today? And how many had challenging emotions today? So those of you who are surprised by this, you're not alone in what you experienced. And the first day of a retreat is often considered to be, for some people, more challenging. And that's a lot of reasons for that. It's the adjustment, just coming to a new place, whole new schedule and food and people, it's going to be challenging. Sometimes it's what your life has been like, and busy and not getting enough sleep, you discover how tired you are here. Sometimes it's you sit down and really start finding out what's here and make space for what's here, and you're no longer overriding your inner life or your physical life, and it catches up to you. So some of the tensions you carry in your body show up when you kind of stop overriding them and go, maybe. And then also some of the emotional backlog of things we have, or thoughts, or concerns, or unresolved issues that also are kind of been put on the back burner. If we stop enough, sometimes they start appearing. How many of you found that your mind was thinking more than you wished today? What were the rest of you doing? Enjoy, you know, thinking just right. And so sometimes there's a backlog of concerns that we have, unresolved issues that bubble up, and we start thinking a lot. So it's important to think of this first day as just the first day, and that's the entry day, and it's necessary, it's necessary to go through this, it's necessary transition. In theories about how rituals work, there's the idea that the ritual begins by involving a transition out of our life, normal life, and into some special sacred space, perhaps, or special space. And that transition is really important. And this is a transition day, that we're making the journey to kind of leave what's behind to some degree, and then enter into kind of a new space. And so we're entering into something. And so sometimes the first day, a couple of days, there's tiredness and variety of things go on. So it's one of the great things to do, and those of you who've done it for many times probably know this, is to be relaxed about it, to not judge yourself or judge the retreat, or don't get caught up in it, but just kind of understand this is part of the process and hold it lightly and graciously, generously. This is how it is. At the same time as holding it lightly and generously, trying not to sink into it or succumb to it or involve in self-pity or anger or, you know, all the kind of things we get reactive to it. Keep coming back. Keep showing up in the present moment. The present moment is a safe place to be. For me, my early retreats, I would have a lot of anger in the first days of the retreat. That was my reaction to the challenges that came up. And I found that the anger was not a was not productive for me. And then the more I kind of believed it or got involved in it or let it kind of lead the show, the more difficult for me it became on the retreat. And so the obvious thing to do then was to be more angry. And so that cycle of having difficulties getting angry and having more difficulties because of that and then getting more angry, it doesn't lead to a good end. In fact, that's what happened to me. I finally would just crash and burn. And when I finally crashed and burned, that's when the retreat began. So that's when I came out into the water, maybe. So who knows what your retreat? We don't know what any retreat's going to be about. Those of you who are on the first retreat, you should know that we don't know what a retreat's going to be about. We don't know what a life is going to be about. And we don't know what our life, the Dharma, just the world, has in store for us or what's coming. But what I do know is that you can really trust the process of what arises here if you meet it with mindfulness, with honesty, with compassion. Something very profound happens in that fact that you're able to, whatever arises here, whatever this is about, you meet it with honesty, you meet it with mindfulness, with careful attention, kind attention, and you're really there for it. Then what needs to happen in you, the process, the path that you need to have, will unfold. And we don't know how that's going to unfold, but I've seen over and over and over again that it unfolds the way it should. So there's no need to think, whatever happens these days, there's no need to feel that it's right, it's no need to feel that it's wrong. It's just the Dharma working through you, and you just go along, keep going along, and you'll see this. You're on a journey here, a wonderful journey. So the theme that we chose for this retreat is, in this translation of the by Bhikkhu Bodhi, he calls it the six principles of cordiality. In the earliest translation of this book, he called it the six memorable qualities. So I looked up the original Pali, and it's not clear what it means. But it looks like what it means, the word, comes from the word sara, which means the heartwood. So the six dhammas, the word dhamma, the six dharmas are qualities that are heartwood. They're the essence. However, the later commentaries say that to be translated or understood as the six delightful qualities. So, and the idea of concord is more of interpretive translation, and you'll see why as we get into it. So whether it's delightful or heartwood or essential, these are very important qualities in the tradition. How these are characterized here in this text, these six, they create love, respect. They are conducive to cohesion, social cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Isn't that nice? And it's not that often in these books here you find the word love. In translation, and so love is a relational emotion, a relational attitude. It's possible to have love with no object, just to be in a state of love. It's quite nice. Mystics sometimes have it, and it's comes with practice. Come with mindfulness practice here to rest in a state or field of love without having to have an object. It's a beautiful thing to have. But generally, it's something we do in a relationship. We can do it in relationship to ourselves. We can have self-love. We do it in relationship to others, to our community. And also, I think, keep coming back to this idea I mentioned last night, we can also have a relationship to the we. It's me, you, and there's we. And we can love we, who we are as a community, who we are all together. And so, So these qualities create love and respect. Respect is a social thing. You know, it's in relationship we have respect. They are conducive to social cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So these are, there are six principles that do this, six practices that are conducive to these things. We'll go through them over these six Dharma talks we're giving. But I just want to highlight that how the Buddha here is really pointing to creating a harmonious or healthy society, healthy community, and that this is actually a very important part of the Dharma. Perhaps the earliest autobiographical, one of the earliest autobiographical pieces we have about the Buddha, describing his own quest for awakening, it says that he saw, he looked around society and just saw that people were fighting and in conflict and violence, and that it dismayed him. The language is actually quite strong in this passage where he talks about this. He was shaken by seeing what was in the society around him. And it seemed like it was seeing what was going on in society that was part of or the motivation for him to look for an alternative, some kind of solution, answer to this. Rather than some personal existential suffering, you know, I'm suffering, he was tuned into what was going on around him in his society. And then he said, but then he goes on in this passage where he describes this, and he says, "And then I saw an arrow embedded in the heart. And I plucked out that arrow, pulled out that arrow, and I no longer floundered and no longer sank." So, he saw the problems in the world, he saw the solution in himself, pulling out the arrow, and he said, once the arrow is pulled, people don't run around sinking and floundering anymore. Not just him, but to others as well. And so one of the ways of understanding what he taught for all these years was he taught how to pull the arrow out of our hearts, the arrow that leads us to conflict, to fighting, to fear, to all these things, that so that we can have a harmonious society, so we can live together in concord and love with each other. Sometimes people say that the arrow is craving, and craving is kind of seen as kind of like the umbrella term for a whole bunch of things that are craving seen as the umbrella term for or the source word for all these different motivations and ways that we act that can cause conflict and harm in our society. So this story, there's a story connected to this teaching that he gives. And the story, it actually involves conflict in the monastic community. And sometimes we think that a bunch of monastics are saints. And that they're supposed to kind of just, you know, float on, you know, walk on water and, you know, and just be kind of junior Buddhas or something. And but often monasteries are very important places in our society, retreat centers like this, because it's often the place where it's people who end up there are often the people who have the most need for it. And it's a great thing that the people who have a need, who are deeply in pain, deeply struggling, it's not working for them, life as usually lives, have a place where they can go and find a way and work these things out and find freedom, deep freedom, through a process of practice. But it means that given that monasteries are kind of like hospitals for people who need to be there, you don't just walk through the doors and enter into the monastery and you're already completely mature. So from time to time, there might be conflict. So, now on that occasion, the monastics at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. They could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. So deep in conflict, they're arguing about something, and they can't get the others to agree to them. And they're stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It's kind of painful to hear this. That's, you know, that metaphor of words being like daggers that can stab people. Maybe some of you probably had the experience of that kind of pain. People say something like that. And it's all too common in our society that people are being hurt deeply by what's being said. And so here it's happening in the monastic community, and they're arguing over something. And we don't know here what they're arguing about, but there is a story in the another text that seems to explain what they're arguing about. And it had to do with maybe a misunderstanding about a minor, very minor monastic rule. And maybe, you know, the fact that it sounds so minor, maybe it highlights what human tendencies can be, and how something small we can invest tremendous importance in, because symbolically it represents many things. It represents being right, being wrong, which some people are very attached to. It can represent what's mine, my territory, my people, my group. In fact, there's two different groups here that are arguing. And so the issue is minor, but the differentiation and protecting one's own group becomes very important. And so the minor issue is that one of the monastic rules is that, see, back then, they didn't have toilet paper. But they had these little water dippers they would use. They'd bring the little dipper or bucket or water with them to the outhouse, and they'd use that for hygiene. And it seems that one of the rules was when you finished using the outhouse, and you if there was a little bit of water left in your ladle, your little bucket, you had to empty it and not leave any in it. And one of the, apparently the monk who was who was specialized in knowing all the rules, he left water in his little ladle. And the other monks, who are a different group, said, "You broke the rule. You left water in the ladle." And that led to quarreling and brawling, with deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. Isn't that amazing? And you know, you have to. When I was a monk in Burma, I was ordained one day. It was in maybe midday, maybe late morning or something. And I was in a meditation retreat for many months, and so I was mostly meditating, but I went in the morning to get ordained. And then I went back in the afternoon to the dormitory where I was staying to continue my meditation. And so in the mid-afternoon I was doing walking meditation. And I'd been ordained for 5 hours or something. And this other monk came up to me and said, "You know, you're not supposed to talk on retreat, right?" But he came up to me and said, "Gil, you have to confess." I said, "Really? What did I do in 5 hours? That now I have to confess." No, he had to confess. It turns out that one of the very small rules is that you wear these robes, and they're a little bit hard to wear. And the outer robe, that lower hem of the outer robe, has to be lined up with the hem of the under robe. And I had let it slip a little bit. So here I was 5 hours into it. You have to confess. So I thought that was a little over the top. But anyway, the point, I think it's actually a nice point, you know, this over the top, because it doesn't take much both to trigger all the kind of forces inside of us that gets into conflict. And it sometimes doesn't take much, even a very small thing, to react to it. You don't know, a small statement, a small kind of protest, a small kind of, you think it's a minor thing, you don't know what where that's landing. You don't know who they are. When I was in the monastery at Tassajara, I was kind of in charge of cooking once, and people ate out of these very small little bowls, and so the cucumbers had to be a certain size to fit in those bowls. So I went over to this woman who's chopping them and said, could you make them a little bit smaller so they fit in the bowls? And she burst into tears. And, so you never know who you're coming to, what her background is, what she was struggling with in her life. And it just pushed her over the edge, and started crying over this, what I thought was a simple thing about making the cucumbers a little bit smaller. So small doesn't mean small. You don't know what's happening in these things. And here an example of these monks arguing. And so the Buddha hears about this. And he asks that both parties come to see him. And I kind of like the way he kind of deals with when he hears about this. First thing he does is he asks them, is what I'm hearing true? Is it in fact true that you guys are arguing and having verbal daggers? And they say, yes. And then he asks him, what do you think? When you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you, on that occasion, maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life? So the monastics tend to be very honest. That's part of the deal, you're supposed to be. And so they say, no. When we're doing that, we have no loving kindness. So then Buddha goes on. When you are arguing and conflict and fighting over it, and you have no loving kindness, either privately or publicly, the word is more like internally or expressed out externally, what is it that you can possibly know? What is it that you can see that you take to quarreling and brawling and deep in disputes? So it's a great question, I think. What is it you know? What's more important? Or what is it that you see or know that would give you cause or lead you to really value and think it's important to be arguing over something? And what's the values? What are you trying to do? What is it that's, why is this so important for you? Why do you give it so much importance? And I wonder how many conflicts that we have in our lives would be seen in a very different perspective if we asked ourselves that question. What do we know? What do we see? What's under it? What's under the conflict? Why this seems to be so important for us? So then the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, there are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What are the six? So I'll read the first one for today, and then we'll go do the six over the course of the retreat. There's a progression in these six, even though I won't tell you what they are yet. The progression starts with loving kindness, and each one in the refrain says it leads to love, respect, cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. But as it goes through them, it becomes more personal over time. To get into the last three. And it becomes more and more into kind of what we would consider maybe deep dharma, deep practice. But the deeper it goes, it comes out to benefit our society, our community, with love and respect and concord and unity, cohesion. And it's this idea, this is why I was thinking about this lines by Rumi, You go into the fire, you come out in the water. You go into the water, you come out in the fire. As you take this journey, going deep in, it kind of go in and then it'll come out and surface into our society and our world. You can't really leave the world behind. But sometimes we do this inner exploration, the inner depth, in order to be turned inside out, perhaps, and be able to come back in a way that into society in a whole different way that's a gift to our world and our society. So the first of the six principles of cordiality is here. I love the word here. Buddha often says the word here. It's one of my favorite words, here. Here. Where else? Here. Here, a person maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards one's companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So maintaining bodily acts of loving kindness both in public and in private. There's a tradition in Theravadan Buddhism that when you go on retreat and you show up and begin your retreat, you begin with doing loving kindness for all the deities, all the tree spirits, all the kind of unseen beings that are in the neighborhood. And I love that the idea of it. I don't really believe in unseen deities and tree spirits exactly. So the literal meaning of it doesn't mean so much for me, but the symbolic meaning of it. We live in a huge unseen world. Unseen world of relationships, unseen world inside our own heart, and we don't know what we're touching and what's being touched. But to begin a retreat by evoking our goodwill, expressing our goodwill, that here, we're not here to harm, we're here because we would like to, your welfare. We're concerned for you. So why would that be the beginning of the retreat? If you're going to go this deep inner practice, some people, and we were talking about this earlier, some of us, that the way that a lot of the convert Buddhists in America came to the Dharma for historical, social reasons that make complete sense at the time, it was often very much through the avenue of meditation and personal experience. In the 1960s, there were people who came to the Dharma after having very profound, very meaningful, transformative, very personal experiences taking LSD. So there was this kind of personal experience kind of orientation. And then eventually what I saw, many people who kind of went that route, as their practice matured, they got turned inside out, and what became important was not their personal experience, but their relationship to the world around them. And because that's such a deep part of who we are, we're not separate from that. But in the tradition, in the old way, or still the way, we begin also there by looking around and creating, kind of settling our relationships with the world. Classically in Buddhism, you don't start with meditation. You said that, didn't you, yesterday? You don't start with meditation, you start with generosity. And generosity is something that creates healthy relationships with each other. And then you practice ethics. I have a friend who's grew up in Taiwan, and then she came and became a graduate student in Buddhist studies. Same place as me, and she took some classes that I taught, and so we talked about her. I talked about her practice and all that, and I asked her at some point, "Do you meditate?" you know, she decided to do Buddhist studies, right, to devote her life to that. And she was very devout, very devout Buddhist. She had a teacher. And she said, no, not yet, because I'm preparing myself for that. I'm getting ready. I don't. I'm becoming more ethical. I'm kind of. And I was kind of surprised. I'd never thought of this idea that you'd have to wait to meditate. You just do it, right? But I was so impressed and inspired by her that she had so much respect for meditation that she felt this was something you want to prepare yourself for. So this idea, and for her, some of it, I think, had to do with her relationship to the world, cleaning it up and all that. And so to establish a atmosphere, environment that feels safe, an environment where we feel like where our relationship to the world is not troubled too much, it's helpful to start a retreat with some expression of goodwill. It doesn't mean that you have to have 100% goodwill. It doesn't mean that you resolve all your issues. But it's something very significant about, at least for now, while I'm sitting here during this retreat, that's the place I would like to come from. By golly, I don't have much goodwill to that person. But I really wish I could. That counts for a lot. That's the beginning of it. And I think that in order to doing that, settling it enough so that when you sit here and you're remembering people and conflicts and unresolved issues, that you've established that, yes, we have these difficulties, have these challenges, but here we're approaching all this from a different point of view. We're approaching it with an attempt to try to meet it with a principle of cordiality, to meet it with our goodwill. I'm fond of the word goodwill as a translation for metta, because the word loving kindness sometimes is too high a bar for some people to relate to. It's hard to have love for people that you have strong antipathy for, but you could have goodwill. You could wish them well. Just don't come too close. You know, it's not. I don't know if it's safe for me to, you know, be in the same room as you, but I wish you well, but please stay away. I mean, I think that's a reasonable, mature thing to say to some situations. Whereas with love, it's like, it's a little bit too, at least in my mind, love, loving kindness, like, oh, like then maybe to let people in too much. But establish goodwill. And what is goodwill? What is metta? I'm not sure what it is. What I do know is that I discovered what metta is for myself by sitting these retreats that we're doing here. I wasn't interested in metta. In fact, when the teachers would do guided loving-kindness meditations, I would tune them out because it was too sentimental, too artificial. You know, I had a Zen background, and that's just too something. So I just ignored all the teachings about metta. So I innocently sat there meditating, doing the mindfulness practice, and getting more intimate with myself, more settled, letting go of, or having them shed, softening a lot of the armor that I had around my heart. And my heart began to kind of wake up, and physically, I felt that physically, that there was a kind of a movement in my heart, and the scales would fall off, and the heart kind of felt more open and warm and bigger, and I would just sit there, minding my own business, and somehow in that tenderizing process of sitting there, of letting go, of showing up, being present for what is. And I sat with a lot of difficulty, but the idea of just showing up for it and being, this too I have to be present for. I'll be present for this. My mind wouldn't wander off. Come back. Be with that. Be with this. Breathe with it. Breathe with it. And things began to soften. Things began to the resistance I had to what was going on, the judgments I had to what was going on, the self-pity I had to what was going on, all these things started to soften and fade away. And in that, what happened was that it felt like was then the deeper, more innate capacity for empathy, the capacity for love, for goodwill, for metta, for compassion, had a chance to kind of begin shining. It's like the curtains were pulled, and so the sun can come into the room. The curtains were pulled from the heart, and in the heart, the sun, the light of the heart, could shine. And I was find myself very surprised to be sitting in a field, an atmosphere of goodwill, of love, of tenderness. The word tender was important for me. A sense of caring for the people around me. A sense of the valuing of people. And a very simple appreciation of the people that I encountered, the people around me. And I didn't even want to appreciate them. It wasn't on my mind. It wasn't like I didn't want, but it's like it wasn't that I hadn't set myself up, but today I'm going to appreciate people. You know, it's like, wow, people are so beautiful. They're pretty wonderful. And sometimes I would start crying because I sometimes felt their pain, and sometimes I would just feel delight. So I don't know what metta is, what loving kindness is, but this sense of empathy, of living a shared life and having this, the organ of perception, this antenna that we have in our heart that can pick up and feel or relate to other people and maybe what's going on in their heart resonates with something that echoes in us or something, or we take it in, we feel it. To see people and oneself without the filter of judgments, without the filter of desires and expectations or resistance or aversion, and to be able to kind of just be there and see, be present, and then to care, to have some caring and wish them well. That's kind of the territory for me of metta, of goodwill. It became one of the great treasures of my life to discover this. I wasn't, and so my resistance to it, my tuning out of my teachers. I remember it was a wonderful day when I was just sitting there with this wonderful feeling and minding my own business. And they came in to do this guided loving kindness meditation. And I said, oh, that's what they're talking about. And then I came to really appreciate it, and it was a great thing to do. So we will be in conflict. We will have disputes. We will have difficulties. We'll have differences with each other. No matter where we go, we'll run into things and challenges with other people in whatever way. And those conflicts and those differences will certainly elicit fear and resistance and pulling back or anger and blame and all kinds of things. So, but when we practice with it, means we don't automatically give in to these things. We don't automatically believe these things, but we begin to show up and be present for what is. Yes, it's like this. Here it is. And the movement of practice, kind of, if I was a mime, if I'm going to mime for you, what we do, what we don't do, and what we do when we do this practice here, it would be something like this. What we don't do is something like, what we do is, okay, here I am. I'm open for this. I'm going to include this here. What's this now? And we practice that on the cushion, in the walking meditation. All kinds of things arise. All kinds of challenges. Some of the ways that we're in conflict is with ourselves. Some of the ways we have verbal daggers is towards ourselves. And so all these things happen. And we train ourselves, we're beginning to learn and practicing with, how do we do that inner movement of like this? Here, yes. Almost like, here, come. Come, my friend. I mean, isn't that nice? We see someone and you go like that. You know, in principle at least, it's nice. You know, come, here. And it's kind of like, you're welcome, as opposed to, you know, this movement. So what we don't do in practice is this. It's more the spirit of, yes, this too, here, here, to whatever's going on. And so we have fear, we have conflict, we have resistance, we have judgment. And this wonderful thing of like, oh, this too. Now, not to accept and say, yes, I agree with you. But it's like, okay, we're going to be present for this. We're going to feel this. We're going to really see this and allow this to show itself to us so we really know it. To really, and I think this is one of my hopes for our society, that we have the ability to really see what we're doing, how we react, how we respond to each other. And this practice that we do here is a training in learning to see what we're doing and then learn, maybe for many of us, learn a new way. Learn, you know, maybe you have your own gestures. My gesture doesn't work for you, but you know, you can probably do two different gestures of your own, like this, or like this, or like this, or like this. Maybe you have your own. But they're learning a new way to be with what is, so that we can find, remember that one of the translations here for the principles of cordiality was heartwood. So we can find the heartwood that's there. Because what's underneath it? What's deeper? If we go into it, go into the fire, maybe you'll come out in the water. So if you go like this and say, here, let me feel what's happening, let me be present for it. Let's see what happens. Let's see where we go to, what it opens up to. So this idea that first principle of cordiality is to offer goodwill, loving kindness to others in physical ways, in acts of loving kindness. It begins with an attitude of loving kindness, of goodwill. But it doesn't require you to have goodwill. It requires you to want to have it. This would be good if we had it. And then a willingness to be present for what is. And it, here, okay, this is actually what's happening now. And a certain kind of a very strong self-honesty. This is what's happening. And then, if you do have goodwill, or you want to have goodwill, a great thing to do is to act on it. And the first principle of cordiality is to offer acts of loving kindness, physical, with your body kind of actions, both publicly and privately. On retreat, there's not going to be a lot of opportunities for big acts of, you know, don't go out of your way and make a big spectacle of it. But there might be very small things you can do. It's possible that, you know, that the food that's at the end of the lunch line is your favorite. But there's a long line of people in front of you. And so you start crowding the person in front of you in the line because, so the goodwill thing would be, don't crowd the person. Just step back and make them space. Don't let them feel hurried while they get their oatmeal. There'll be time for you to get, you know, your sunflower seeds. So make some space for them. Just a small thing. They don't even know you're having goodwill. They just think you're just there. But for you, you know, because you feel this impulse to kind of crowd them. Or perhaps, you know, maybe there's dessert one day, who knows? And and there's only one cookie left. And there's one person behind you in line. So what do you do? You just, maybe there's a chance for an act of goodwill. Let them have the cookie. Or maybe just, no? Or that's going too far. Or you cut it in half. So you can share it, and then you eat it slower. Half the speed to make up for it. And it could be that you simply, when you sit down, you're standing in line, for example, for the meal, that, you could be impatient, or you could do loving kindness. You could just kind of appreciate the people there and wish them well and hope that their retreat goes well and just exercise that muscle. It might be a nice thing to do. There might be small little acts you can do. It could be you open a door for someone, and that's a little act, the front door maybe. And the idea on retreat is you don't want to do big things, because sometimes big things stir people up, and they think about it, and they feel they're obligated to return it, or what should they do? It's a silent retreat, but you want to say thank you, and you didn't say thank you, and then for the next whole sitting, you're thinking about, oh, this person thinks I was ungrateful, and it kind of gets complicated quickly. So we try to keep things really simple here, but there might be simple things you can do. And in what way does your acts of loving kindness, or one of the things you can do is we're all supporting each other here. It's a mutual support system here where you have jobs you're doing, and when you do your job, whatever you do, could you actively do it with the idea that you're doing it for the welfare of the community? You could do it just to get it done with. You could rush to do it so you can do more important things, like come up here and meditate and do some loving kindness meditation. Because it only counts if you're sitting meditating. Or you could infuse the very doing of your job so your job itself becomes an expression of goodwill for the community you're with. And on retreat, it's certainly valuable to create an environment of love, respect, concord, unity, cohesion, all that. Because it's very deep work we're doing here. And and the depths of our inner life is often connected to our social life, life of our family growing up, life of our communities locally growing up, that some of the deepest suffering that human beings carry come from what happens in our growing up, in our relationship to other people. We don't underestimate how deep that can be. It's kind of like who are you? I'm me. Is a kind of a delusion. Who are you? It's more like I'm we. It's not that, to actually, and so it's so deep, this connection, that as we begin creating an environment where we're trying to create love, concord, respect, it actually helps these deeper places inside of us that sometimes are hurt, sometimes are challenged, sometimes are afraid. It helps them kind of to feel it's okay to come out into the sun, to show themselves and to relax and to soften. So we try to create that here, that kind of field for each other. Not at the expense of denying what's really happening, not to override what's happening, but to hold what's happening. So if you feel the opposite of goodwill, if you have fear of opening up, if you have anything, try this. Try this to that, to hold that, make space for that, allow it to be here. One of the really important things to do when you're practicing here, if it happens that you get afraid, there's fear as you sit here, one of your tasks is to help the fear feel safe. Here, my fear, come. As opposed to trying to fix the fear or push it away or argue it away or something, but help your anger feel safe. Help whatever's there so it can kind of unfold and move. And as you go into the water, as you go into the fire, maybe it'll come out as water. Don't be afraid of what's inside. And then our goodwill becomes realistic. Then we can come with caring for our community in an honest, realistic way, because we know ourselves well and we learned how to hold what's there for ourselves. So that's the first principle of cordiality, is to practice physical acts of goodwill, both publicly and privately. I like it privately, I like secretly here, you know, just so people don't know. But so don't make a big project, don't kind of think about it too much here, but how to do it. But, there'll be plenty of opportunities as you go through the retreat to just, you know, be generous to each other in nice ways. And that hopefully creates a nice support for you to keep going with the mindfulness, to keep letting go of the thoughts that distract you, that cause you to wander off in thought and disappear from the present moment, from here. Keep coming back. Come back to your body. Come back to your breathing. Come back to here. And then do it again. And again and again. It's a simple thing to do. And be curious. What is this? What happens? How do things unfold when I keep showing up here? Come back. Be here. And maybe as you're here, for anything that's here, maybe this gesture, here, just welcome, or here. I'm open for you. I'm available. Here. Pain, physical pain, here, I'm here. Emotional pain, yes, here, I'm here for you. The distracted mind that wanders away, there's an art to say, yes, here, this is a distracted mind. I'm not going to condemn you, I'm not going to fight against you. I see that you're distracted, here. Thank you, but I'm going to come back to my breathing now. Over and over and over again. Take good care of yourself while you're here. As we started off this talk, the first day is often difficult, or tiring, or challenging. And so some of you might go to bed early the first night, and that's fine if you feel like you need to do that. There's a way of taking care of yourself. But one of us, or both of us, will be here at the 9 o'clock sitting to do some little thing with you. As part of the ending of the day. Okay, so thank you. So the custom is, or the on these retreats, at the end of a talk sometimes is to go back into your meditation posture, in a chair, sitting up, and then closing your eyes, and then take a couple of minutes to kind of reconnect into that retreat mode and the practice mode, so that you can make a transition back into that